Welcome to East Meets West. I'm Olga.
I'm Tara Reid. Glad to have you back. Well, Olga, that was quite something. We've had Easter holidays for both Orthodox and for Catholics.
And I know, surprisingly, right after we filmed our previous episode, when we were discussing Trump's performances on the Catholic Easter and the Orthodox Easter, I ran into an article, very interesting one, and I started looking deeply into that and discovered that the amount of Orthodox Christians in the United States has almost doubled since the times of the pandemic. And of course, I'm not here to preach, rather to analyze, but it seems to me that it reflects some mood in the US society. What do you think about that?
I think that that's true. I think you have a younger generation coming up that's looking, that's seeing a lot of corruption in the government and feeling that hopelessness. And then, of course, the U.S. president being as bellicose and warlike and with his language, it was very disheartening, I think, to the younger generation. Talking to my daughter, you know, who's back in America, and her friends who are of that age. And they're looking more to a more proper way of being in the world, and it just it was so culturally devoid of spiritual goodness of what happened. And I think that's, and also you have the all the congressional scandals. You know, I was just interviewed by Newsmax. They were asking me what I thought about Solwell, who got caught doing all those things on video. And I think that the younger generation is seeing the Epstein files, all these congressmen that are basically having to resign. I think there's three more that are going to have to resign because of sexual misconduct. They had to stop the internship program at the Page program in the Congress because there was rampant sexual abuse by the members of Congress. And so I think the younger generation is looking to the older, like, what are you doing? Like, what is happening? Where is our moral compass? And, you know, spirituality is important to have. And, you know, whatever your religion is, and, you know, the Orthodox Christian religion is beautiful. It's traditional and beautiful.
And in the article, it was specifically stated that those were mostly males and young males who are shifting to Orthodox Christianity nowadays. So I guess they're actually looking for some traditional values, for something stable.
Yeah.
You know, something stable in this world
where
they what
chaos
used to be a scene is not considered something a proper thing to do the next day, you know? So something stable, some proper, something genuine maybe even. But let's discuss it with our guest who is already with us.
Yeah.
And who actually is the combination of two worlds in one person. Stanislav Krapivnik used to be an officer at the U.S. Army, was born in the USSR at Lugansk, and now moved back to Russia and living in Russia. So actually, Stanislav possesses the expertise of the U.S. Army, how logistics is organized, how the strategic decisions are being made. So really an interesting person to discuss what's going on in the world right now, right?
Yes, excellent. It's good to have you, Stas.
Thank you for being with us.
Oh, it's a pleasure.
You've been all over the place. I've been watching some of your interviews because you have such military expertise.
So if you don't mind, let's start with the military expertise that we all need. I guess, guys, you all have seen those pictures of the U.S. Marines on the flagman U.S. aircraft carriers based not far from Iran, not far from the Strait of Hormuz. And they were sending pictures to their relatives, to their parents, of the food they're being served on those aircraft carriers.
Food ration.
And that's really, really unappetizing because those trays were almost empty. One had a handful of boiled carrots and something that really looked as a gray shoe sole. I suppose it was meat or something.
A gray shoe sole.
No, honestly, I couldn't even get
feeding the U.S. Army shoes. What do you think, Stas?
But, you know, as for us, we're thinking of the U.S. American Army as of something that Trump just recently called the most sophisticated, the best, the most powerful army in the world. So is it actually how they are being fed there, or is there some logistical crisis going on?
Well, those aren't Marines. Those are naval personnel. There may be some small contingent of Marines on board. But normally, I mean, that's the type of crap that the Army gets fed out in the field. That looks like that. Gray ooze on top of a brown slop. That's called T-Rats. I ate plenty of that. You don't know what you're eating, but when you're hungry enough, you'll eat it. The Navy normally eats really well. So if they're down to that, that means the supply chains collapse. They can't get ships in with supply, or they're not hitting. They're not making port. More likely, they haven't really been making port call. The Ford has been out to sea basically almost nonstop for 11 months. So those men are exhausted. And they're breaking. This is pretty much abuse of the personnel. More likely, a good chunk of them will quit once their contracts are up, if they're allowed to quit. There's a thing called needs of the military. So if your MOS, your military operational skills are needed, it doesn't matter if your contract expires or not. You stay until you retire, until your skill set is no longer needed in crisis mode need. Yeah, the Navy normally eats well. So it's the Army and the Marines that eat like crap. Everybody else eats pretty damn well. But by the way, those pilots, when they come back, they sleep under white sheets and they eat steaks. That's how that works for those Air Force pilots, too. That, like I said, that they're being served that level of rations. There's two pieces of tortilla on one tray with like basically a scoop of what looked like either burger meat or maybe
grinded meat, something like that.
Yeah, it was. I mean, that says that they're running out of supplies, basically.
I know there are also their relatives are trying to send them even toothpaste and some specific women's accessories because they lack even them. Can you imagine?
Hygiene, yeah.
Yeah. They've been sending is going to be just as difficult as getting everything else in because somebody has to deliver it, and you're bringing it into a war zone. So, this is a big problem. If you cannot supply your ships, you can't keep them out to sea very long. And the fact that the Ford has been out to sea for 11 months, the 80% of the toilets that are overflown, I've talked to naval personnel. That's a soft mutiny. That was a soft mutiny. People start getting sick and tired of it. They start flushing ropes, T-shirts, other material down the toilets to clog them up. The filters get clogged up, and then you get what you get. That's trying to get the ships back into port so they can get off the ship.
Oh.
I mean, normally, rotation's like 6 months. It's been out to sea for 11 months. They've had two short stops for a couple of days to resupply. But that's it. So those people are pretty worn. From a guy that had bone spurs for five times that couldn't serve in Vietnam, but gave a speech about how everybody that commanded Vietnam were a bunch of idiots, like he would have shown them how to do it. He finished a military academy. He could have gone as an officer, but you know, that would entail risking his own hide. And I'm talking about the president of the United States, of course.
Yeah.
Five deferments, not to go to Vietnam. That was his generation's, kumbaya. He decided not to go. None of his kids have ever gone. None of their kids will ever go. These people have absolutely no skin in the game. They're quite happy to send everybody else's kids off to fight. They're not going to do it.
Well, they're not even fighting for the U.S. They're fighting for Israel. And that's the other big objection that we're seeing amongst Americans and those that are being more outspoken. And as a matter of fact, I don't mind just saying this right here, but I was uninvited to an event in Florida that I was supposed to speak at because I've been very outspoken about how we shouldn't be in this war with Iran and how the Palestinian people have been, it's been a genocide. And for that, there's some MAGA that decided I shouldn't come and speak about anything. So I was uninvited. But back to you and this, are you finding that the Americans that you're talking to are having the same malcontent about their possibly having to die for Israel?
And can it come up to a sabotage on these aircraft carriers?
Yeah.
Yeah, I won't say that this is particularly just fighting for Israel. Look, there are three factions here at play. Two American factions, one Israeli faction. Which is, by the way, why you can't figure out how to do negotiations with Iran. On the one hand, you got the neocons. They're not fighting for Israel. They're fighting for their own pocketbooks. They want to get rich.
Lindsey Graham.
By getting rich, they want to... Yeah, they want to control Iran. They don't want to destroy Iran. They want to put their own person in charge who's going to give them all the infrastructure and everything into their hands. They're just going to rake in the cash, and they're going to have the hegemony and control. So you got that one party from the U.S. Then you got the second, I'm going from least insane to most insane. Then you've got the second insane party, which is the Israeli, the Jewish Zionists, which are, by the way, considered by traditional Jews to be heretics. So the Israeli Zionists, they don't want Iran, period. They want it destroyed, because and then it'll be Turkey and it'll be Egypt, because they want greater Israel, and they want to control everybody, and they need everybody destroyed and minimized. So already you have two factions that really don't agree at the end goal. Yeah, they agree they need to take on Iran, but they don't agree on the end goal. So what do you do now? But then you get the third faction, and that would be the Christian Zionists, which are heretic Christians. They're not right. Christians, they're heretics. Right. And they just want to destroy everybody because they want the end of the world. So between these three, there is no common ground. So there's no common ground to negotiate with Iran either. And you start looking at it, and you're looking at the fact that the neocons are the most rational group. Those psychopaths that want a hegemony over the world are actually the most rational group out of this triumvirate. And the other two are just more extreme than the previous. And all are screaming mass destruction, mass murder. It's just one wants mass murder in the Middle East, and the other one wants the end of the world, period.
Where does Trump fall? Because some are saying he's like a Christian Zionist. In fact, someone very outspoken said that.
Trump is not Christian at all. Look, let's be real.
He's not Christian.
Some do say the opposite, right?
He didn't put his hand on the Bible. But he's trying to quote Christian. He's trying to use
the
born-again Christian.
So is Hegseth, and wound up quoting Pulp Fiction.
I know. Hegseth.
Pseudo-Bible quote. I mean, that's pathetic, but yeah.
The Book of Tarantino. Yeah.
The Book of Tarantino, Act One. that was pretty bad. I hope at least he was drunk when he was doing that, or whoever was writing that for him. This is why you have editors, if you for people like that, if they write their own speeches. Trump is not a Christian. Trump has never made mention of being actually a Christian. What he is, I have no idea. You know, if anything, this is a man that worships Saturn. Saturn in the sense that the ancient Greco-Roman god Saturn was the god of the state. He represented the state, the power, the organization. Trump worships the state, the power. With him, of course, on top of that state, he is the state. It's like Louis the Sun King. I said, you know, I am the state. After me, you know, it could flood. I don't care. But I am the state. This is what Trump is looking at. He is the state. And he's stated that in multiple times. You know, the famous, the infamous, I guess you could call, question him, what are your breaks? What controls you? He's like, only my morality and my mind. Well, there was another interview done on the same line. The guy asked, well, inside the U.S., what does control you? He's like, oh, my morality, my very high morality. And the interviewer's like,
nothing.
Well, I was kind of hoping you'd say the Constitution and the courts. Like, well, yeah, those are two, but we'd never get there because I do everything only that's right. You know, and this is the person you're dealing with. He's narcissistic as hell. Now, the Christian Zionists are playing to that. They're pumping up his ego very effectively. You've got the con artist Paula White. This is the woman that was screaming, send me $1,000 check and I'll unleash the seven holy miracles upon your house and other things like that. I mean, this is a shyster who is, I mean, she's a con artist. She's a flat, like all these televangelists are. They're a flat con artist. It's a pyramid scheme, basically. And the prosperity gospel, which means, you know, give me money, I'll pray for you to get money. God wants you to be rich, not spiritually rich, not in wisdom, but materially rich. These are heretics. They're pseudo-Christian heretics, and these are the people that surround Trump. You know, this is the woman that said Trump is the anointed of God, and to raise your hand against the anointed of God is to raise your hand against God. And, you know, this is, whether Trump believes any of this, it pumps his ego up, and that's number one. And plus, there's the little dementia working its way in there.
Yeah, a little sundowners.
If we can get back to what's going on in the Strait of Hormuz, from the military point of view, can we please, I would love to ask you.
Yeah.
Now it seems that United States is kind of to block the Strait of Hormuz, to unblock it, because it was being blocked by Iran. What do you think of all that and of the possibility of the ground operation, or how are they going to unfold it?
Well, the problem here, quite simply, is there is no negotiated peace. Even though they agreed on most points, which are the easy points, the two game killers, in this case, game enders, was one, uranium. Russia's offered three times to take the uranium and hold it for Iran as a neutral party. Well, Russia's also not neutral, but as the most neutral party in this issue. Iran didn't say no. They didn't say yes. They were like, yeah, it's something to consider. The Americans said, oh, hell no. The thing is, the U.S. needs that uranium. Look, Trump's biggest economic bubble is the AI bubble. It's something to consider, by the way. The Chinese just showed a quantum computer, at least on a limited scope, that could outdo the big AI data centers. So even as they're building these giant AI data centers, they may be already going the way of the dinosaur. They're already becoming yesterday's technology. If what the Chinese showed is real and can be replicated and can be expanded upon. But for these giant AI centers, you need uranium. The U.S. cannot process uranium. Russia has 70% of the world's capability to process and enrich uranium. U.S. doesn't have any uranium to begin with of its own. There's just zero uranium in the continental United States. There's some in Canada. If you want uranium, pretty much you come to Russia to get processed uranium. Here's 450 kilos of 60% plus grade uranium, which would go a long way to feed a lot of nuclear reactors in the U.S. Of course, the U.S. wants that uranium. It wants to steal it. It wants to get it one way or the other. That way it can avoid paying for to Russia. And it wants to get it out of the hands of the Iranians. For the Iranians, it's their insurance policy, so they're not going to give it up. That's one. Two, the U.S. is demanding, flat-out demanding, that Iran give up the Straits of Hormuz. Straits of Hormuz are not neutral waters. They've never been and never will be neutral waters. The entrance of Strait of Hormuz is controlled by Oman. The rest of Strait of Hormuz is controlled by Iran. Those are national waters. The U.S. has demanded that Iran just cedes the territory to the U.S., which will then be taking tolls off of every ship going through and making money on its own. That's the reality. Of course, Iran said, go pound sand. We're not going to do that. Sorry. So there is no way out of this situation because it's one extremist view or another extremist view on this. There's no middle ground on this. There's no place to negotiate. So the U.S., what the U.S. is doing to counter-blockade is to blockade any Iranian ships leaving and any ships, like, say, the Pakistanis leaving and going to Pakistan. So it's a blockade of it's not a blockade of a blockade. It's a blockade of Iran while Iran's blockading the airship. Now, Iran at first said, okay, we'll open it as we understand because the U.S. is supposed to release their blockade. And the U.S. said, well, no, we're not going to do it until we get your uranium, which Iran said, okay, fine, and the blockade's back on. And now the U.S. has attacked, flat-out attacked, an Iranian ship. They shot it. They damaged it, and they boarded it in Iranian national waters. The only reason U.S. ships were able to get that close without becoming reefs was because there was a ceasefire. So basically, you probably say the ceasefire is over, and we're back to war. There's no other concept here. And Iran, by the way, launched drone attacks on those American ships. What damage they took, we don't know. I'm sure they did. Just like the Ford's 30-hour combat with Lint, fire wasn't Lint fire. It was more likely the Ford got hit. Because, look, those aircraft carriers and the other ships, you know, the aircraft carriers alone have thousands of airtight compartments. They could have closed off that compartment and just let the fire smother itself. The fact they had to fight it for 30 hours means there was a hell of a lot more damage done than just some fire because of Lint or electrical. I've spoken with various naval personnel, so, you know, we've never heard of something like that. It more likely was a hit. The Ford got hit, so more likely these ships got hit sitting in Iranian waters. So we're back to war, which was inevitable. And the U.S., by the way, you know, ceasefire, the U.S. was just repositioning a lot of units to try to restart this war. But the U.S. is short on everything. U.S. Manufacturing is down. It's all done to maximize profit, not to maximize potential or quantity. All those missiles are manufactured by hand. And the reason they're done that way is because the U.S. military normally goes to a contracting term called cost plus. So if it costs 100, if we decide your profit margin is 10% and this item costs you $100, we pay you $110. See, you get your profit margin. If you're a supplier, your job is to maximize the cost of the item to maximize your profit. Whether, you know, if it's done by hand, you can inflate the cost of it incredibly and thus increase not only how much you're getting paid, which is not going to cover, which is more than covers the cost of manufacture, plus a profit margin that looks bigger. So all these missiles are put together by hand. They're very limited in quantity. It takes a long time to rebuild your stocks. So there's limited what the U.S. can do. Now, if they go down the route of putting boots on the ground, if we already had boots on the ground, that whole little, we're rescuing the pilot that was no rescue operation. I mean, look, you know how rescue operations done? One helicopter, you got a guy sitting on a mountain with a beacon. You fly in a Black Hawk, specialized Black Hawk called a Pave Hawk. They can refuel in midair, so they got longer range. You fly it in as fast as you can. You drop him a ladder or a sling or a rope, whatever, to fasten him. And before he's even on, you're flying back. Your job is to get in, get out ASAP before anybody even realizes you're there. That's how you rescue a person. You don't bring in at least four C-130s. And I'll tell you why there was at least four C-130s. You don't bring in little bird helicopters on it. You don't bring 100-plus special forces and rangers to have a firefight on the ground to rescue one guy. You don't do that. You could do that to try to grab uranium or personnel from that nuclear facility that was just down the road, about 30 kilometers down the road, from that airstrip. Now, what do we see on the airstrip? We see two C-130s that were destroyed. And on the fuselages that had been burned, you see scar marks from shrapnel, from small arms fire. You see the four destroyed Little Birds, and the entire tarmac, including the runway, is pocketed with artillery with artillery craters. Translation: first of all, what you don't see 100-plus corpses. You don't see 100-plus prisoners of war. So obviously the guys that flew in, however many of them died or were injured, we'll probably never know. But whoever came in, they all came out. So in other words, if there's two C-130s that were destroyed, there had to be at least four C-130s all in all, because you can't fit 100 guys on one C-130. You're going to need at least two. So there was even a lot more equipment, that the destroyed equipment we see. How many casualties the U.S. military took, we don't know, and probably will never find out, or won't until 10 years later somebody writes a book about it. Somebody survived.
And we never saw a picture of this rescued pilot either. Although I guess they would like to boast it if they had one, right?
Yeah, I mean, he would be making media rounds, and that's not happening. Yeah.
No, I think there was a plane shot down, but look, let's look at it this way.
No, I don't think they rescued him, is what we're saying.
Yeah, there's no proof he was rescued.
No, I'm sure they rescued him. I'm sure they rescued him. Look, this was a bait to cover up for the actual mission.
Then where is the pilot?
But that's the point. You're not gonna the whole mission wasn't about rescue. The cover was rescue. Look, first of all,
you're
these
saying
planes,
it was to steal the uranium down the road.
Yes. Yeah.
Okay.
Of course.
Wow.
Look, those planes, they don't fly by themselves. Planes, the fighter bombers, they normally fly in pairs. This was a lone F-15 flying around. It gets shot down. The guy in the back seat is Lieutenant Colonel. He's the XO of the squadron. That's somebody that normally does not fly on a mission, period. That's somebody that's in headquarters controlling things. That's his job, not flying a mission. His job is to control or assist in the control of the squadron and squadron operations. He's the liaison between the squadron commander and the various staff members of that squad that plan and execute those operations. So he shouldn't be on there unless he's volunteered on there and volunteered for a specific purpose, to get shot down. And then you have a cover of a guy sitting there, and we're coming to rescue, but we're coming to rescue. We're bringing a whole company of special ops guys for something else. That was a good cover on why they were there. And if they'd gotten that uranium, Trump would have been parading around screaming how great he was and how much he did. Since there was not a word about it, obviously mission failure big mission failure.
Interesting.
Yeah, it is interesting. But bringing us back to the bigger question, right? Let's zoom out a bit about the Iran war. So here we are. The U.S. is in this. And as this is going on, the peace talks with Russia regarding Ukraine, that's over. But the U.S. is not giving money to Ukraine. That's obvious. And Zelensky's got his hand out in Europe as much as he can and is prancing around there. What do you see geopolitically happening with, because obviously Trump is trying to find an exit route because he's in a
trap.
Quagmire. And what do you see happening with the peace talks and what's going on with Ukraine and
Zelensky
Russia?
Just the other day once again suggested a meeting with Putin in Turkey, as you may know.
Yes.
Again. So what do you think of all
that? Yeah, what do you think of all that? And kind of like just what's going on, the tension between all of it.
Mm-hmm. Well, first of all, Zelensky desperately needs to meet with Putin to be legitimized. Zelensky is an illegitimate leader who's despised
he's
by
not
his population.
Elected
anymore. He's a dictator. This is not a monarchy. This is a dictatorship. So he has absolutely no. A monarchy has a base of why a person's there for life. He's a monarch, and that's a constitutional form of government. And Zelensky's form of government is a presidential form of government. His time in office expired 2 years ago. He's not planning on leaving. He needs to be legitimized. If he can sit down at the table with Vladimir Vladimirovich, he automatically legitimizes himself. At least that's what their hope is. Of course, yeah, that's what he wants. As far as, look, first of all, the U.S. is still supplying Ukraine. Let's not kid ourselves. The U.S. is not giving it away. It's, quote, selling it through the Europeans. It's just that the U.S. is very short on anti-aircraft equipment. Everything's going to Israel. Everything's going to Jordan, those areas to defend. There's just nothing left for the U.S. to give because it manufactures such low quantities. U.S. is still giving Ukraine targeting information. It's still U.S. Military still firing HIMARS missiles at Russian targets, including civilians. Let's not kid ourselves. Those are Americans in those HIMARS. They are firing. It's being targeted. The targets are picked by U.S. generals. Everything I've said for 3 years, by the way, in December of 24, the New York Times confirmed everything I was saying. Thank you, New York Times. Even the attack of missiles were not something the Ukrainians demanded. It was something the American generals in charge demanded. So let's be honest about it. The U.S. military was and is fighting in covertly, if you can call it that, against Russia. But the U.S. isn't interested in fighting Russia. The U.S. is interested in making money off the war against Russia. So what we're looking at is, look, realistically, the U.S. will leave NATO. NATO will transform into a European army. We will have a big war with Europe. The moment the U.S. leaves the European contingent, there's almost 100% guarantee there's going to be a war because the threat of two nuclear superpowers knocking each other and the rest of the world out of existence dissipates. Now you've got a conventional war. You've got the Europeans that are being pushed into this big conventional war against Russia. The U.S. is going to make money of it because, look, the Europeans can't manufacture their own equipment. They're just incapable. They don't have the technology anymore. They don't have the fuel. U.S. has a giant stockpile of older equipment. They've got 2,500 M1 tanks in storage. They have another 2,500 M1A1 tanks in storage. U.S. is upgrading the M1s to M1A1s. That's changing the 105 to 120 millimeter main gun, changing the armor from steel to composite armor. There's a reason they're spending money, because this is the equipment that's going to be shipped to Europe. They've got about 5,000 Bradleys in storage. Look, you know, what do you do with the old equipment? You either pay money to get it chopped up and for scrap metal, or you sell it as new to somebody that really, really needs it. And if somebody needs it, you got to make a market for it. You get a nice war going. The people that are in charge of Europe, most of them have jobs waiting for them in the U.S., in think tanks and universities and so on. They'll do what they're told. They're not going to stick around. I mean, let's be honest about it. And look, I think it was Forbes magazine, if I remember correctly. Back in 1998, I read the first article along the lines of the U.S. needs another good war. World War II in the U.S. is called the good war. Not because they're fighting some Adolf guy who, by the way, was put in power by a good chunk of the U.S. New York Stock Exchange people. The U.S. oligarchs are backing Hitler just like they were backing the Bolsheviks during the Bolshevik Revolution. They're making money off of all of this. There's lots of books that document go through by archival documents that show this. There's a lot of, Ford, General Motors, all of these companies were producing equipment for Nazi Germany right to the end of the war. In fact, it was DuPont that gave Hitler the formula for artificial rubber, without which there wouldn't have been World War II because the modern military can't run that.
And speaking of DuPont, they funded some of this U.S. senators like Biden, who I used to work for. DuPont put Biden in office. Yeah. And some other senators. Yeah.
But what do you think about those tensions within NATO that are ongoing? Because Spain is definitely at odds with the United States. President of Finland just recently said that Trump may find himself in a lonely place.
And
as
Italy.
He voted. Yeah, so Italy's a number of Trump calls NATO paper tiger, as we all know. So how do you see what's going to happen with all that?
Look, the point of the U.S., first of all, none of these countries paper tiger. I mean, the job in the U.S., and I'll finish the thought on the article in the Forbes. So this is back in 1998, and they're talking about we need another good war. We need another European war where Europe is destroyed. We write off of our debts. We become creditors. We do another Marshall Plan, and we become rich off of Europe. We need a big European war. This is 1998. So you know the elites are talking about it at least 10 years before that. So for 20 years, they've been molding Europe to be to fight Russia in one form or another. This is their big way of putting themselves on top and making a whole lot of money off of a destroyed Europe. And the European leadership is in the pocket of the U.S. Straub, all of them are. I mean, it's the people like Orban and Fitzo, they were not in the American pocket, even though they're, quote, allied with Trump or something like that, but they weren't. They were nationalists looking out for their own countries. These people, their number one job is to get the money, make the money, and then get the hell out. And look at people like even van der Leyen. She says, yeah, I feel just at home in the U.S. as I feel in Germany. Yeah, she's not going back. When she loses her position, she'll be leaving for America. She stole well over $1 billion with her husband on the jabs, on illegal contracts with Pfizer. So these people are mostly corrupt. They have a way out. And we've seen how quite a few of them already left, and they will continue to leave. The U.S., the difference is, if you go back a little bit longer, there was a thing called Operation Gladio. The U.S. started control Europe since 1948. It used initially the stay-behind armies that the Nazis set up, and then they developed the same thing in the other countries in Europe, and they used terror and assassination all throughout Europe to try to control the European leaders. This was back when you had people like Schroeder or people like Thatcher. They were actually very strong leaders. You could agree with their policies or not, but that's beside the point. Willie Brown, these people were hard for the U.S. to control. So they used terror, they used pressure tactics to control them. But in the meanwhile, you've got the American, well, I won't even call it the American establishment. You've got the elites, these Epstein elites. They started growing a new generation of European leaders, which is who we see now in power. Why they don't represent what the people want. Most of them have absolutely miserable support from the population, 10-12%. But yet they are in power, and the next people up are no better than they are. These people have been grown specifically for these roles, to do what they're told by their paymasters, not by the people that elect them, if they even elect them. I mean, we see what happened in places like Romania. We see what happened in places like Moldova. We see opposition members in France that are denied ability to run, and so on and so on. This is, quote, managed democracy, if you want to call it that. And their job is to make, in the end, money for their paymasters. And their paymasters are not the people of Europe. That's what we've come down to. And if it means, and the other point is, too, if you look at the elites in Europe, they really hate their own people. I mean, just listen to them. They hate their people.
Well, they definitely do everything to hurt them.
Yeah.
To harm them economically and in any other way.
Yeah, yeah. So
they look down their noses at them worse than any aristocrat from the 1700s or the 1600s. They really despise their own people.
You've definitely seen in politics in Europe and in the U.S. I would say, I would put this over to U.S. politicians. U.S. politicians have, especially the Democratic Party, but as well as the MAGA, they have like no care for the working class or for the, you know, people of America. And that brings me back, speaking of the working class and middle class and upper middle class of America, you lived in part of the heartland. You lived in Texas. And could you tell our viewers a little bit about your earlier life and how you came to be in Russia? Because you are both Russian and American.
And if I may put it even more straightforward way, you served in the U.S. Army. You were a captain, from what I know. So why did you leave? And even further, could you imagine that you could be assigned to something that could harm your motherland? Sorry if it's too provocative question for you, but I cannot help asking it. Our viewers would definitely ask.
Motherland meaning Russia.
Of course.
Yeah.
I come from a military family. My mother's side is very old Russian aristocracy from the times of Ion Grozny, Ion IV, Ion Vasilievich, and old aristocracy, Mishiny. Built, by the way, the fortress that then became the city of Livne in eastern Orlovska Oblast. So that's that level. And my grandfather was old German aristocracy. From my mother's side, and my father's family were enlisted, and under the Tsars, enlistment was 25 years. So that was a career, consider lifespans back in those days. So I guess it's in the blood. I left for political reasons. The main thing came in 99, second half of 99. I transferred into the Dragon Brigade, which was headquarters unit for 18th Airborne Corps. And then what you saw, except for the short time that we were preparing for the invasion of Baghdad, I was in G3, so that's ops, operations. That's planning and execution of operations. The rest of the time, we were preparing for war with Russia. It was just flat out. While George Bush Jr. was looking in the eyes of Vladimir Vladimirovich and saying, I saw his soul, we'll be friends. Oh, the U.S. military was preparing for war with Russia. That was the nonstop issue. It wasn't something that restarted, something never stopped. It wasn't as intense up to that point because they all figured Russia was going to collapse on its own. But come 1999 and something goes wrong and Russia doesn't collapse on its own, Vladimir Vladimirovich shows up and things start going in the wrong direction for the American elites. And, of course, intensity of preparation starts going up because, oh, crap, it didn't die. Why didn't it die? So that was, the U.S. military is always preparing for war with Russia. This is not something that was exclusion. This is something that was a standard practice. Not China, not anybody else, but Russia specifically. So, yeah, that made up my mind. I wasn't going to go fight my own people. So it took a while to get out, again, because I was under contract. And then, my contract goes needs of the Army, so...
So how do you find it here, finally?
What are your thoughts about Russia as compared to how we were educated in the U.S. about Russia?
Educated. U.S. is educated on stereotypes. I used to get in fights every week to 2 weeks. I was in a fist fight. I grew up in the South. I love the South, don't get me wrong. But I grew up in the South in the climax of the Cold War. In the city of Charlotte, which at that point had about 500,000 people and probably some like 40 Russian speakers. I mean, the level of ignorance toward Russians, just to understand as an example, my mother taught Russian in the Charlotte Community College. And I remember she was telling me, she came back, she was all flustered. She had some old woman that was taking her course, Russian, comes up to her and asked her, "Are you really Russian?" She's like, "Yes, I am." It's like, "You can't be. Why? You're not red." Good thing they never heard of the white Russians, the green Russians, the black Russians, all the different factions of the Civil War. But they quite literally understood if you're red, you're not red because of the color of the politics, but they were expecting you to be red-skinned, like, I guess, demon or something.
And then, of course, the stereotype about being communist, and they don't realize that Russia is no longer communist. It's a capitalistic country, has a very different kind of political system. And I think, you know, one of the good things about our show is we try to educate the Western audience about what Russia's really like.
So how do you actually feel here after living so many decades in the United States and now you live in Russia? How do you find it here?
Well, this is my home. This is always my home. And in fact, I never left. There's many reasons. I mean, I came back home. I took my family back. My wife is from Tbilisi, Georgia. She's not foreign to the culture, obviously. We came home. I mean, this has always been my home, and I never denied that. I was always planning on coming back. Just leaving the U.S. is very difficult. You know, I had a pretty high-paying job in Texas. I was considered a sixth percentile on wealth. For all that, you're still in debt. Everybody's in debt. Unless you're extremely rich, everybody's in debt. Our big spend was groceries. We spent 2.5 times what Americans spend on groceries. So our kids had fresh vegetables, fresh fruits, so they were healthy. We didn't really eat out, things like that. But you think on paper you look like you're rich. In reality, you got like $300 at the end of the month still in your hands, and everything that's extra on spend has to come out of those $300, which is impossible. So yeah, you like it or not, any emergency, you wind up going in debt.
Because that's the illusion that's being distributed around the world. And a number of those who moved to the United States, they finally face, difficulties with paying the medical care bills and things like that. Mm-hmm. And just to end up with, as you said in one of your interviews, your father used to be liberal when he was in the USSR, but when he moved to the United States, he turned into the most conservative person on earth. So that's what's coming with the disillusion. But thank you so much. I know we're running out of time. Thank you so much both for your military expertise and for these personal emotions that you're sharing with our viewers.
Yeah, thank you very much.
Absolutely.
Thanks for coming. Thanks.
Thank you.
We'll have you on again.
Always a pleasure.
And for our viewers, please stay in touch with us on our social media pages.
And thank you so much for being here. And you know what? I've noticed there's been an upclick in people subscribing. Please keep subscribing. Hit the YouTube subscribing. Follow us on Telegram and X. And, we really appreciate all the views and the comments.
It keeps us alive.
Yeah. and Olga got some wonderful comments as well, which is nice.
Thank you.
So keep doing that. If you have questions about what it's like to live in Russia, please feel free to just ask on Telegram. We have that discussion group going.
We're here for you.
See you next time.
Take care. Bye.